The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's good to be back with you after a few days off down in Jerusalem. Appreciate the subs sitting in, or standing in, I guess, if they're using the standing desk. Got this email just yesterday. While you were away, the subs that are on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show are great and are doing a great job. You left the TDRS in good hands. However, don't get too excited, Sam. It will be wonderful to have you back from your trip to Jerusalem, and in hopes you will talk about your journey. So we had a great journey. We were able to meet with Dr. Mazar as per usual. We met her at the YMCA, a little cafe there, and I think we've met with her at that location probably 15, 20 times over the years. So it's our old hangout, I guess you could say. We also got to meet again with the director of Elad, or the City of David Foundation, or the City of David, I guess it would be more precisely. He oversees that, as well as the Ophel, or the area of the Ophel, where we've been digging in years past. So it was good to chat with him and to just get a feel for the many projects that he's involved in. He really is a remarkable man, promoting Israel's history, Jerusalem, the history that goes back thousands of years. And he's anxious for another dig in the City of David. And when that does happen, he has said repeatedly to us that it will be Dr. Mazar to complete that project that goes back many, many years. As I think some of you know, we dug at the City of David in the early years of our relationship with Dr. Mazar, back to 2006, 2007, 2000, I think 8 and 9 maybe. It was around that time, though, that we moved across the road to the Ophel, and we've been digging there during the excavations we've had with Dr. Mazar ever since. So it will be exciting whenever that does happen, when we can return back to the palace, King David's palace. And while we were in Jerusalem, we also looked at a variety of properties. We're, as I think some of our listeners know, we're very anxious to expand our operations in Jerusalem with more office space, more living space, maybe a place for an exhibit or a museum exhibit of some kind. So we're certainly keeping our options opened. And hopefully we'll have more to report on that in the next few weeks. Well, what a week it has been for the United States, for Great Britain. Today, of course, is Brexit Day. And, it's not overshadowed here in the UK. But if you're in the United States, or if you're some of our members or listeners from around the world, it's been quite a week as far as prophetic news. Certainly, it's been quite the week. If Brexit gets overshadowed somewhat, that's pretty incredible. This is the Times here in the UK. You can see the cover there. Brexit. It's time. It happens tonight at 11 p.m. This one here, this is from the Daily Mail. I'll just read that to you. It says here, at 11 p.m., our proud nation finally leaves the EU, still a friend of Europe, but free and independent once more after 47 years. 47 years. Pretty amazing. It says here, now on this momentous day, we salute a new dawn for Britain. And so there's quite a lot of optimism in the air. There has been since 2016 when they had the Brexit vote. Of course, there's been a lot, just like in the United States, there's so much division. It's deep, the division is. And the fighting over Brexit that's gone on for 3.5 years. Finally, a victory for those 52% that voted for this 3.5 years ago. We had an email in response to Sam's show yesterday. He got into this to some extent. It says, Brexit becomes a reality on the 31st of January. This is from one of our listeners. The most significant geopolitical event since the fall of the Berlin Wall. The world is about to be radically transformed. How will this impact? We're seeing how it's impacting the United States and Britain here in the short term. The election of Donald Trump in 2016, Brexit happening that same year, the rise of nationalism around the world. We'll play a clip from Nigel Farage here in just a second, where he says these populist movements, in case you haven't noticed, he's speaking to the bureaucrats in Europe. In case you haven't noticed, they're popular, and we are glad to be leaving. That's the way Farage put it. What are the European nations thinking? We know it's going to be whittled down to 10 kings. That's Revelation 17 and verse 12. So it's about to be dramatically restructured, that European Union. But what started out as an economic community 47 years ago, that's what Britain entered into. And of course, Herbert Armstrong was the lone voice that said, you're going to regret it. In fact, it's not going to work out. There will be a divorce. That's what Herbert Armstrong was prophesying 47 years ago. In fact, he was talking about it even before 1973. This is Nigel Farage. I think this was on Wednesday. His final speech in front of the European Parliament, clip one.
So this is it, the final chapter, the end of the road, a 47-year political experiment that the British, frankly, have never been very happy with. My mother and father signed up to a common market, not to a political union, not to flags, anthems, presidents, and now you even want your own army. For me, it's been 27 years of campaigning and over 20 years here in this Parliament. I'm not particularly happy with the agreement we're being asked to vote on tonight, but Boris has been remarkably bold in the last few months.
That's Nigel Farage. They've had their differences, Farage and Boris Johnson. But as he points out there, we could argue about the details, I suppose, but you have to give Prime Minister Johnson some credit. He has been bold. He has been courageous. And really, the events of this week, we were talking about it when we were in Jerusalem. Brad McDonald was there. We were there with Brent Noctegal, Andrew Loker, my father. We were talking about all of these events the very first night that we're there. Of course, the big news in Judah or the little state of Israel was that joint press conference or the big announcement on Tuesday night in Washington, D.C., the White House. And there's Donald Trump, President Trump, and Prime Minister Netanyahu announcing as the Trump administration refers to it as, the deal of the century. That was Tuesday night, and then we're just reading what bits of the news we can while we were trying to get other things done in Jerusalem. Incredible. Just incredible. Really, we put together a PAC video, by the way. I didn't even mention the details for the PAC, but that's coming up tomorrow night here in Birmingham. It's about 20 miles away from the Edstone campus here. We've got 128 registered for tomorrow night. We've got 135 registered for Sunday. So we're projecting maybe just a little over 100 or hopefully over 100 for each night. And we put together this 3 or 4 minute video just highlighting the events of the month of January. Here we're at the last day of January today, January 31st, Brexit Day. And you look at this past month, or you look at this past week, and what you're seeing is, and we're not really used to this, are we? You're seeing leadership. You're seeing bold leadership in some cases. The consensus, remember that word from the impeachment hearings? The consensus, it's taken a real beating. The elites that didn't want Brexit to happen, that tried everything that they could to prevent this from going forward, just like they're doing everything they can to destroy President Trump or to destroy Benjamin Netanyahu, And yet, here are these three individuals going forward with bold action. And that's why we're seeing some pretty dramatic events. It's not to say that they're all great. Like I say, it's going to be interesting to see the ripple effect. What are some of the other nations that are maybe on the fringe looking at Britain, cheering, waving their flags in the European Parliament as they leave for good? How will things be restructured? How is it going to be reshuffled? It's going to happen quick. Boris Johnson has he either has a speech or he's preparing a video for television tonight. BBC is already saying that it might not play the video because the BBC is not getting its way, you see. The BBC hates this. And even, sadly, you're seeing the people, the supporters of Boris Johnson that are having to, kind of keep their feelings subdued because we sure don't want to offend the deep state. The deep state's in a state of blues right now because they did everything that they could to stop it. And even today, they're trying to throw a wet blanket on everything. No fireworks, no alcohol at the parades tonight. Let's do everything that we can to make it certainly not jovial or exciting. They're not going to... Big Ben, there were talks of, I guess, the Big Ben clock sounding off. I'm not going to do that. And as I say, even Boris Johnson himself, and I guess as a politician, you can understand him not wanting to offend the 48% that voted against it. In any event, Nigel Farage isn't exactly holding back. Here's a little more of what he said on Wednesday in Europe, clip two.
But the most significant point is this. What happens at 11 p.m. this Friday, the 31st of January, 2020, marks the point of no return. Once we've left, we are never coming back. And the rest, frankly, is detail.
Once we leave, we are never coming back. Wow. Wow. You know what Mr. Armstrong said. It's never going to happen. Britain's not going to be any part of it. He said it back in the 50s, and he said it right at the end of his life in Mystery of the Ages. Farage talked in an article, he wrote an op-ed this morning about how that many of those who wanted to leave now all of a sudden seem embarrassed again because the forces from the other side are so strong, so negative. This is the end of the world the way they see it. Couple more clips here from Mr. Farage, clip three.
And you're very good at making people vote again, but what we've proved is the British are too big to bully, thank goodness. So I became an outright opponent of the entire European project. I want Brexit to start a debate across the rest of Europe. What do we want from Europe? If we want trade, friendship, cooperation, reciprocity. We don't need a European Commission. We don't need a European Court. We don't need these institutions and all of this power. And I can promise you, both in UKIP and indeed in the Brexit Party, we love Europe. We just hate the European Union. It's as simple as that.
That's Nigel Farage on the way out. The British resurgence, Hosea 5:11, following the in the way of Jeroboam. You had Mike Pompeo, the Telegraph reported this morning. Mike Pompeo was there to say, hey, we're ready for a trade deal now that you're out. let's come together. Farage wrote in his op-ed this morning, our exit from the single market could hold the entire rotten project below the waterline. He's talking about the European Union. And while the Titanic sinks, our nation will be on a lifeboat rowing to a bright new future. Optimism is in the air. Well, in the short run, there's a temporary resurgence. We've told you this. He doesn't quite have it right, though, with respect to the whole European project. But there may be some moments in the weeks and months ahead where it looks like that's going to completely go under, as he says there. But we know that 10, that's what we want to keep our eyes on. Revelation 17, 12, we know that 10 nations are coming together. What are the European nations thinking? One final clip. This is Nigel Farage yesterday, clip 4.
I'm hoping this begins the end of this project. It's a bad project. It isn't just undemocratic, it's anti-democratic, and it puts in that front row. It gives people power without accountability. People who cannot be held to account by the electorate. And that is an unacceptable structure. Indeed, there's an historic battle going on now across the West, in Europe, America, and elsewhere. It is globalism against populism. And you may loathe populism, but I tell you a funny thing, it's becoming very popular. And it has great benefits. No more financial contributions, no more European Court of Justice, no more common fisheries policy, no more being talked down to, no more being bullied, no more Guy Verhofstadt. I mean, what's not to like? I know you're going to miss us. I know you want to ban our national flags, but we're going to wave you goodbye.
There's the Brexit Party waving the national flag, the Union Jack, at right before, by the way, his mic was cut off, because I guess that violates the rules in the EU Parliament. Anti-democratic. What you see there is just a little bit of bold leadership. A little bit of bold, assertive, courageous leadership. He's following in the steps of Boris Johnson. And when you look at some of the other things that happened this past week, as I say, this is what the consensus, in many ways, this is what the consensus, the administrative state, is so angry about. They hate bold, decisive leadership. They hate it. They want everyone to have equal say. They want to impose their will, the will of the consensus, on the general populace. Well, coming back to, again, these earth-shaking prophecies, the Ten Kings, what Mr. Armstrong said about Britain not being a part of it. He said it back in 1945. He said it in 1956. And then he warned Britain in 1973 when it joined the economic community. But here they are, like you heard from Farage, here they are. Now they want an army. This is no longer just an economic union. This is a political union. And now they're going to go after an army. And you can bet they're going to go after it that much faster, given what's happened, even just this week. I can't imagine that sits well with some of those German and French leaders. These Brexiteers waving the UK flag in the EU Parliament. Melanie Phillips talks about the division here in the UK over Brexit. It says the arrogant and egoistic Remainer establishment, with minds sealed shut against any challenge to their worldview, have learned precisely nothing from their defeat. They will now blame Brexit and those who voted to leave the EU for absolutely every disadvantage Britain may now suffer, however irrelevant it may be to the issue. See, they won't let this go. Just like with impeachment. We'll talk about that here in just a second. But if it's all ended today for Donald Trump, if he's acquitted by the Senate, still, well, we'll play a montage for you in just a moment. They won't let it go. They'll pivot to something else. The next attack. Melanie Phillips says here, for many of those who voted Brexit, the iron has entered their soul, abandoned by the entire political establishment, vilified, insulted, and abused by the media and intellectual nomenclature as racists, xenophobes, imbeciles. They have now learned they are not powerless against this vicious cultural behemoth. They defeated it, she says. not through violence or extremism, but through the simple power of their own voice and vote, through democracy, decency, and rationality. See, this is a good thing, so many of the conservatives are saying. We won. We're winning. President Trump keeps with that refrain over and again. We are winning. They are losing. And the thing of it is, this is, well, it's giving us a false sense of security. The deep and angry divisions, they're still there. But it is fascinating to just watch how different the course can be when you do have bolder, more decisive leadership. On Tuesday, as I say, we settled into Jerusalem Monday night, had a day of activity Tuesday, and then that evening, all over the news, I guess it was over the midday period in Washington, but in Israel, it was, I think, 7 in the evening, and there was Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Donald Trump introducing this new peace plan. Well, really, it's not exactly a plan, as I'll cover here in just a second, but let me play for you a montage. This is President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu on Tuesday, clip 5.
On Sunday, I delivered to Prime Minister Netanyahu my vision for peace, prosperity, and a brighter future for the Israelis and Palestinians. This vision for peace is fundamentally different from past proposals. Under this vision, Jerusalem will remain Israel's undivided, very important, undivided capital.
We will also remember January 28th, 2020, because on this day, you became the first world leader to recognize Israel's sovereignty over areas in Judea and Samaria that are vital to our security and central to our heritage. That Israel must have sovereignty in the Jordan Valley and in other strategic areas of Judea and Samaria. For too long, far too long, the very heart of the land of Israel, where our patriarchs prayed, our prophets preached, and our kings ruled, has been outrageously branded as illegally occupied territory. Well, today, Mr. President, you are puncturing this big lie. You are recognizing Israel's sovereignty over all the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria. And because I believe your peace plan strikes the right balance where other plans have failed, I've agreed to negotiate peace with the Palestinians on the basis of your peace plan. You have been the greatest friend that Israel has ever had in the White House.
That was from Tuesday. That was the big news from Tuesday. And then it just was superseded by other events as the week unfolded. Carolyn Glick, for her part, she says, responding to this plan, she says, President Trump didn't offer us a perfect plan, but he offered us a plan that we can live with. It's a plan that we can live with. That's from Carolyn Glick in response to this deal of the century. But as I say, I think I agree with Melanie Phillips, who says it's not really a deal. It's an ultimatum. You had President Trump. And then Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, who is the primary architect of this plan, very detailed, very thorough plan, more detailed than any other president has presented. But you had both of them basically saying to the Palestinians, to Mahmoud Abbas, this is your last chance. This is your last chance to establish a Palestinian state. Here's an opportunity for you to double the size of your territories. Here's an opportunity for you to get $50 billion of investment coming in from some of your Arab neighbor states. Well, I think Abbas's response was that we reject this proposal 1,000 times, he said. And Melanie Phillips doesn't seem real optimistic that they'll ever accept it. President Trump put it on a 4-year window of opportunity. But Melanie Phillips said, at least this president is telling the truth about what the problem has been in the past. This is from Ruthie Bloom at the Jerusalem Post. She said, U.S. President Donald Trump's speech on Tuesday, in which he outlined the deal of the century that has been 3 years in the making, was nothing short of earth-shattering. More earth-shattering developments. Today, you've got Brexit. Tuesday, you have the introduction for the deal of the century. She talks some about what Prime Minister Netanyahu was going up against during the Obama years and how that he came in reaching out to the Muslim world. She refers to the Cairo speech in 2009. She praises Netanyahu for managing Israeli affairs during such a difficult presidency where there was so much hostility from beginning to end coming from the United States. And then what happens after that? In a complete about-face from Obama, she says, the Donald went to Israel. He moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, withdrew from Iran, from the Iran nuclear deal, recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, halted funding to UNRWA, demanded that the Palestinian Authority cease its pay-for-slay policy, declared that Israeli settlements were not illegal, and never once called Israel to task for defending itself through strikes on targets in Gaza and Syria. What a difference! A complete about-face, she says. It's a breath of fresh air. There have been so many blessings, so many benefits for Israel during the first 3 years of this administration that you had some commentators preparing the Israeli citizenry for making huge sacrifices for peace. Some of them thought they were being set up for giving up a lot more land in exchange for a piece of paper. A strategy that hasn't worked in the past. Instead, they get the president of the United States coming out and offering them another gift. It's not perfect, but it's something that we can live with, says Carolyn Glick. It says here, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas already had declared the plan to be a non-starter before he even knew what it contained, and he shunned meetings with U.S. administration officials. For the first time in his career, Abbas's tantrums didn't work. See, he's used to them working all the time. He throws a tantrum, and then whatever the U.S. president, Democrat, Republican, it doesn't matter, they try to coddle the authoritarian. That's just been the way. It's happened for decades. This time it doesn't work. It says Team Trump responded to his snub by shrugging and treating him like the tiny fish in the miniature pond he actually is. The affront to his ego, which gets a far greater boost from the international community than it does among his own disgruntled people, has been so enormous that he doesn't know what to do with his rage. It says, but even Abbas wasn't prepared for what Trump had to say this week in the East Room of the White House, with a beaming Netanyahu at his side and a room full of adoring Republican Jewish dignitaries punctuating each of his sentences with a standing ovation. Well, you want to talk about Prime Minister Netanyahu's leadership and the divide in Israel, it's just as sharp as it is here in the UK. It's just as sharp as it is in the United States. But wouldn't it be something if this, the events of this week, also give him a big boost in his next election, the fourth, I think, in a year and a half, as they try to settle this stalemate politically. You had Benny Gantz, who was there in Washington to receive or to give his nod of approval to this peace plan as well. But it was Netanyahu who was front and center during the big announcement, as you saw from that montage. So here's the four-year window. Here's the four-year window. Melanie Phillips isn't super optimistic, but she says this: for the first time, here's an American plan that puts the security of Israel first and foremost. It's therefore the first time that the United States has unequivocally supported Israel's future existence. The first time that a U.S. administration comes in there and actually tells the truth. Jared Kushner, I saw it in a clip while I was in Jerusalem, speaking with, I think it was CNN, as he said, look, they've been led by, the Palestinian people have suffered under corrupt leaders. They really need new leadership. That's the problem. They don't have bold, courageous leaders. They have corrupt leaders who are filthy rich, even as the people of Palestine, or the Palestinian people, I should say, even as they suffer. There were surveys of Israeli Arabs where there's a pretty strong showing of support for Israel's government. People, Arabs, who'd rather live over, they'd rather live under an Israeli administration than Mahmoud Abbas or Hamas. Well, that's part of the story that rarely gets told. And yet here you have a U.S. administration coming in and acknowledging the obvious. The biggest obstacle to peace is the Palestinian insistence that Israel be wiped off the map. They don't even accept Israeli statehood. What a difference. It's a pretty bold step. Now, again, we know from prophecy, Zechariah 14 and others, that this is not going to bring peace to the Middle East. In fact, the peace plan that will finally bring peace to the Middle East, it's something we talk about often on this program. Your Bible prophesies of real solutions to peace in the Middle East. We've even had a brief glimpse of it going back to the days of Herbert Armstrong. My father's written that booklet on the momentary peace that you saw there between Israel and Egypt going back to the 70s and 80s. In any event, when you consider the events of this week, I think it was Wednesday when Donald Trump wrote or rewrote this new trade agreement with Canada and Mexico. And there he was celebrating as the news media. They did everything that they could to try to downplay it or to focus strictly on impeachment, nothing but impeachment. This is from the Associated Press. It says Trump was renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement. He said renegotiating this was probably the number one reason that I decided to lead this crazy life that I'm leading right now. This was probably the number one reason I wanted to become president, was to renegotiate these dreadful deals to get something better for America. And his political opposition, they have been fighting him ever since he came down the escalator. Notice how the AP puts it. It says it also gave the president a chance to at least briefly shift the focus in Washington, where Trump's impeachment trial has occupied center stage for weeks. Oh, yes. All of these bold steps forward. It's just intended to distract you away from the real news. The impeachment. In fact, all of this impeachment nonsense, that's the fake news. The actual events, they don't get covered. In fact, they are covered up. Because what his enemies in the news media and the Democratic Party see, and what they don't want Americans to see, is that this is a presidency that has had a lot of success, particularly with the economy. Again, we're seeing some bold, decisive leadership. Listen to Chris Matthews. He's far to the left. This is him on MSNBC last night acknowledging what is more and more becoming a pretty obvious truth. Clip 11.
20,000 people in South Jersey the other day. Some incredible show last night. I talked to somebody in Pennsylvania. He knows exactly about Pennsylvania. Don't ask me because you'll probably forget who it is. Registration is going through the roof up there with Republicans. And there's issues like fracking, which will kill at least two of the Democratic candidates up there. There's so many things moving right now in Trump's direction.
Even Chris Matthews acknowledges that there's so many things moving in the direction of this president. What a tide. There's a tide in the affairs of men, as my father has been saying. And what we're seeing in Ephraim, in Manasseh, in Judah, what we're seeing in the United States, Britain, and Israel, we're seeing the tide at peak level. The resurgence. It's just temporary, but it is quite the resurgence. Certainly has been this week. It certainly has been this month. The Associated Press also reported that, I guess, the Republican senator, one of the weaker ones, Lamar Alexander, he made a statement yesterday saying that he was going to vote against calling for more witnesses. So they've got Murkowski, they've got Collins, and they've got Romney. I guess it'll be a 50-50 split, and that the Republicans would win in that case. I'm a little unclear about some of the details with how they settle a tie, but still, it looks like there are opportunities to get more witnesses, more evidence, as they've been screaming for. That's now out the window. And we could be seeing this impeachment trial ending with the president's acquittal even today, or perhaps this weekend, Monday or Tuesday at the latest. This is from Laura Ingraham's program last night. And listen to, the Democrats are already reacting to what's inevitable here. And she has a little montage at the end of her comments with several Democrats saying how they're going to respond should that happen. Clip 6.
We all know, unless something really bizarre happens, in the next 24 hours, President Trump will surely be acquitted by the Senate. And that should be the last word on it, right? Wrong.
He will not be acquitted. You cannot be acquitted if you don't have a trial.
No trial, no vindication. No vindication for the president or anyone else.
There cannot be a true acquittal if there's not been a fair trial.
A trial without truth, without key evidence, without witnesses and documents, would render the president's acquittal meaningless.
So they're already lining up together with the same talking points. Even if he's acquitted, he's not acquitted. He's illegitimate. He, like Nancy Pelosi was saying a few weeks back, he's impeached forever. Here's your commemorative pin. He's always going to be impeached. Mark Thiessen at the Washington Post, he gives a little history these last few months and how that the Democrats, they didn't issue subpoenas for certain witnesses. And that's because they had this fight in court over executive privilege. He says at the Washington Post, House Democrats planned this week's standoff over witnesses from the very start of their impeachment inquiry. If you doubt that, just ask yourself a simple question. Why did House Democrats not only fail to litigate executive privilege issues before sending their impeachment articles to the Senate, but also block a federal court from issuing a ruling to decide whether the president could claim privilege? So they had subpoenaed this deputy national security advisor back in, October, Charles Kupperman. And the White House said, nope, you can't have that because of executive privilege. So it went right to the courts. And then right before the judge was about to make a ruling, the House Democrats withdrew the subpoena. And then told the judge, now don't make a ruling on this. It's just a moot point. And the judge complied. That's what's explained in Thiessen's piece. And then it says here, why did Democrats prevent the court from ruling on the merits of the president's claim of executive privilege? Because the ruling could have undermined their impeachment case. So they knew they weren't going to get the witness. the witnesses they wanted, or if it was going to be settled in court, they knew it would take too long. So remember, they said, "No, we've got to hurry. We've got to. He's a threat to national security. He's dangerous, this president." And so they forced their will on House Republicans. They got the witnesses they wanted only, and the ones that they couldn't get, well, they just went public through the media and said it's because of, Republican stonewalling. But they had planned this fight in the Senate from the beginning. That's why after rush, Nancy Pelosi then put the brakes on it and said, "You've got to get us more witnesses," because they knew their case was so weak. But here they were, they actually had it in court. It was actually to be settled by a judge. But they withdrew the subpoena. It says here, on December 18, the House passed two articles of impeachment, one of which charged President Trump with obstruction of Congress for refusing to provide witnesses and documents. That's what he's impeached over. Because of executive privilege. You can be sure, if Barack Obama, if they requested of his staff, if they subpoenaed his Valerie Jarrett or somebody like that, he would have, and his lawyers too, they would have shut that down in a heartbeat. Every president would have. But Donald Trump, this is a different president. This is a different ballgame, the way the radical left sees it. He's got to be attacked from every direction, relentlessly. Everybody who's ever had a discussion with him. We've got to know. We've got leakers. We've got insiders. We've got tell-all books. We've got subpoenas. And then if they don't get one out of all of the leakers and tell-all books that they have gotten, well, you hear how they respond. He says here, imagine if the court then ruled just days later that the president's claim of executive privilege was valid. It would have destroyed the Democrats' case for obstruction. To prevent that from happening, they decided to block judicial review and then impeach the president for seeking the very judicial review they had stymied. See, it's all a hoax. It's all a carefully orchestrated attack. Not using the Constitution. They're leading the way by undermining their constitutional duty. Kim Strassel at the Wall Street Journal, she made a good point today, saying the impeachment trial of Donald Trump is coming down to one big question. Will Democrats, by crying wolf, drown out the more legitimate Republican cry of foul? See, all the investigations, the trials, the impeachment proceedings, it's all meant to drown out the real corruption. Well, sure, they're trying to take out President Trump as well, but it's also to conceal their own evil behavior, their own unconstitutional acts. She says foul has served as the GOP's most powerful and honest argument from the first days of these impeachment maneuverings. Democrats broke every standard of due process, transparency, and fairness in their House investigation, making a mockery of their constitutional duty. They've just broken the rules, the laws, all the way through. Spied on President Trump, spied on his administration before he even became president. And then the investigations. And then the Mueller flop. And then the turning on a dime to Ukraine. Is it Russia? Is it Ukraine? Can't decide. Whatever will stick. Victor Davis Hanson, he said in his piece this week, yet it's now as if neither Mueller nor Horowitz ever existed. As if we have forgotten the thousands of hours of investigation that found no Russian collusion, but indeed discovered the systematic warping of the FISA court by allegations of such falsities. It says, as if to prove that the Mueller investigation was never biased, Andrew Weissman now appears on MSNBC. Well, just like all the other deep state players, Andy McCabe, James Comey, James Clapper, they've written books, they're sought after on cable news, regular contributors. All of this, you see, all of this, the crying wolf, unfair, illegitimate. It really is covering up the actual crimes. Listen to one of the White House lawyers yesterday as he talks about just how dangerous this is for the American Republic. Clip 7.
We've never been in a situation where we have the impeachment of a president in an election year with the goal of removing the president from the ballot. As I've said before, that is the most massive election interference we've ever witnessed. It's domestic election interference. It's political election interference, and it's wrong. They don't talk about the horrible consequences to our country of doing that, but they would be terrible. They would tear us apart for generations, and the American people wouldn't accept it.
Massive election interference. If you have time today, look at my father's, I'm not sure if this is in mailboxes yet, it's the March 2020 Trumpet magazine. Brad McDonald referred to it last night in his Trumpet brief. America has been fundamentally transformed. Here again, my father refers back to some fairly recent history. He talks at the start of this article about the impeachment charade that's going on right now and how it shows that with the Democrats, there is no limit. There are no limits to what they're willing to do to bring down this administration. And my father writes, people need to understand what a dangerous threat this is to the very foundation of this nation. And he refers back to what Barack Obama was saying when he became president in 2008, came into office in 2009, promised to fundamentally transform the United States of America. And he had a lot of success over the course of 8 years. Back in November, my father refers to this this campaign dinner where Barack Obama was speaking. And he talked about, look, we've got to be pretty subtle about these things. We've got to bring all this about in an underhanded kind of way because, well, the typical, the ordinary American, he or she, they don't think like we do. We on the radical left, those of us that are out pushing our agenda forward. Well, it's important that we get a popular showing of support as well. Listen to Barack Obama from November, the middle of November, just a few, I guess, 2.5 months ago, clip 8.
Even as we push the envelope and we are bold in our vision, we also have to be rooted in reality. And the fact that voters, including Democratic voters, and certainly persuadable independents or even moderate Republicans, are not driven by the same views that are reflected on certain, left-leaning Twitter feeds. Or the activist wing of our party. This is still a country that is less revolutionary than it is interested in improvement. They like seeing things improve, but the average American doesn't think that we have to completely tear down the system and remake it. And I think it's important for us not to lose sight of that.
That didn't get nearly enough coverage when he said it back in mid-November. I'm glad we have spotlighted it in this latest Trumpet. But as my father brings out, what he's essentially saying there is, look, the average American doesn't think this way, but I do, we do, those of you in this room, these Democrat donors, of course we think this way. We are revolutionaries. We've got to bring down the system. That's the way so many of them think. Herbert Armstrong was writing about this decades ago. He was writing about this in the 1950s. This Marxist way of thinking, how that they infiltrate the educational systems and so on, government, the popular culture. The average American doesn't think this way, and I think we can't lose sight of that. In other words, we've got to do it in an underhanded way. My father says this, Mr. Obama is contemptuously and openly discussing what he meant by fundamentally transforming America. Now that he's out of office, he tells us what his real goal was and still is, to completely tear down the system and remake it. And how does the news media react to this? This revelation? This admission? Well, they don't even refer to it for the most part. What was it that Kim Strassel said? One big question, will Democrats, by crying wolf, drown out the more legitimate Republican cry of foul? By crying out, screaming at the top of their lungs about unfairness, about illegitimacy, and then look at what they're doing, fundamentally transforming the United States of America. We don't realize how close our republic came to being totally destroyed. My father brings this out in Saving America from the Radical Left. What would have happened without the leadership that we're seeing? And not just in America. But don't get too comfortable. Don't get too casual. Don't let a false sense of security lull you to sleep. Because it's very temporary. But there's no denying what their aim was. It's to destroy. To tear down the system and to remake it. President Trump pointed this out at a campaign stop last night in Iowa, clip 9.
They want to nullify your ballots, poison our democracy, and overthrow the entire system of government. That's not happening, I can tell you that. Today's Democrat Party is run by left-wing extremists.
They want to overthrow the entire system of government. That's what the president was saying. Now, we I forget what year it was, when the radical left, they made such great gains in the House back in the Bush administration, and we were talking about this dangerous turn for the United States, this Nancy Pelosi-led revolution, and then that culminated in the Obama administration from 2009 to 2016, and of course, we came out with America Under Attack in 2012, 2013 to tell you where this was leading. And there's the president last night saying as much. Yeah, they want to take down the entire system of government. Listen to Mark Levin. He's an American radio talk show host. And listen to him describing the real aim of the radical left. This is from last night, clip 10.
They are corrupting the civil society. They are undermining faith in our system, ladies and gentlemen. They will burn down this entire country for power. And we've seen this before, all over the world, with psychopaths who get control and power.
We've seen it before play out in history. Just burn down the entire country for power. What was it my father said? We're seeing just how far they're willing to go to return to power. Well, God intervened, didn't he, to save America temporarily. We're in the midst of a temporary resurgence even. And wasn't that on full display? Even this week, today is the day of Brexit. Today, the impeachment trial could come to an end with an acquittal. You have the deal of the century for Israel earlier this week as well. But coming back to President Trump, Victor Davis Hanson said this, and again, keep this in mind with respect to that Jeroboam prophecy in 2 Kings 14 and such. He says, very few politicians in memory could physically endure the invective, hate, and furor aimed at Trump and his family daily over the last 3 years. Much less could any president function with 90% negative media coverage, moles in the executive branch monitoring his every breath, and an unhinged opposition whose reason to get up in the morning is to end Trump. That's what we've been witnessing the last 3 years. And yet it just keep the resurgence just keeps going forward. As my father said in the recent trumpet, the latest, he says America's current president, Donald Trump, is fighting back against that radicalism and having some success. Perhaps the most important is the way he's exposing the crimes and evils of the radical left. He is fighting back. He is having some success. But as my father brings out in that same article, the division is not going to go away. And there is a civil war that's prophesied. And so don't let the resurgence lull us to sleep. As I said last week, we've got to prepare. We've got to prepare for what's coming. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.